Okay, Brian, I've been playing games on the McLuhan blog run by Alex Kuskus, and I set up a question. I made a quote, McLuhan talking about how James Joyce was greatly influenced by Chaucer, but never wrote or talked about it. And McLuhan said a lot of artists keep their influence secret. So I floated the question, what artist, scientist, film director had a great influence on McLuhan? And so a whole bunch of people for a week and a half were making attempts, and they were citing historical figures, literary figures, and then I had to say, no, this is during McLuhan's lifetime. So that led to one person. I was talking to, we know him as Bipple, but he's online as Zarvax Altman last night. And he had made a few guesses. And then he said, a guy who really must have had an influence on McLuhan, a big deal, was Don Thiel. And he didn't know it, but he just guessed it. Yeah. He just figured it out.
He didn't say Don Thiel as a direct guess for your riddle, huh? That's funny.
But he was so, nobody else had a clue about it. Nobody could see that coming. I knew they wouldn't see Don Thiel. They don't see Don Thiel as a great artist, scientist, or film director. And so there was a bit of a trick there, but I'm going to prove that it applies. So I was so impressed with Zarvox even suggesting that Don Thiel. I mean, he came up with a factor on his own that Don Thiel had influence on McLuhan. He just didn't think. He wasn't thinking in relation to the game.
Right.
So I said, for Zarvox, that's so good that you came close like that. I'm going to give you credit. I'm going to say you did it. So I said, you go out there and say Don Thiel. He said, I'll put it on there with a question mark. And so he did, and then I said, bingo. And then immediately Andrew McLuhan, Marshall's grandson, said, okay, Bob, state your case. And Alex Kuskus came in and said, Don Thiel was a top-notch Joyce scholar, and he said a couple other things. But then a little later he said, didn't Don and Marshall not get along for a while, and brought up the problem over Don's first book on McLuhan called The Medium is a Rearview Mirror. So with that, I haven't been online doing the show here. I don't know if any more remarks have been made by anybody, but I brought Brian on because this is Brian Taylor on the line with me. Brian could have figured it out eventually.
Brian should have guessed Don Thiel. It's more should than could.
Really. Well, why didn't you?
First of all, I think that I assumed that McLuhan had mentioned Don Thiel. I guess I wasn't 100% sure of the boundaries of that. I knew that he had mentioned, one of my guesses was Nietzsche, for example. And I know that he mentioned him at least once in the letters, but he didn't spell his name right, and maybe that was the only mention. So I don't know. I guess I thought that he at least mentioned Don Thiel somewhere. But that definitely occurred to me as when I was juggling around this question. It was a great probe because you can think about it all over the place in terms of McLuhan, but it's also in terms of what is Bob's answer,
Yeah.
And so that could go all sorts of places. That's why I was guessing some surrealists. I realized, maybe he never mentioned André Breton, and maybe he considered himself a surrealist, so that was his big influence as a character or something, his jester character. Anyway, the point is, along the thought of who is Bob's answer, I'm sure that Don Thiel even occurred to me at some point, and I probably meant to give some response listing a bunch of people that, knowing Bob, it might be one of these people.
Right.
But for some reason I didn't, or I was looking more for a historical. I was trying to, I guess I was too misled by Mark Stallman's reframing of the question as an analogy, and I was looking for more of a
more of a
precedent that. But then later, also, I was thinking, of course, Don Thiel really did have a big influence. Whatever, that's for you to explain. And I knew that you would think that, but I was also, after you had given the final in his lifetime clue, I was still trying to think of someone that would have influenced him more in the kind of early days or like Cambridge days,
right.
rather than a U of T friend kind of thing. So,
well, that's partly the thinking of the Cambridge days. I posted McLuhan's letter to I.A. Richards in 1968. Did you see that yet?
Oh, no.
Yeah, and he totally puts on Richards. He's polite, and he thanks him for his great influence back in the 30s. But Marshall starts saying some of his cliche media points about visual space and Plato and this and that. And he started like, hey, well, so what do you think? Do you think Plato really had no clue about visual space caused by the phonetic alphabet? And he has these leading questions, like he's a little kid bugging the guy. And it's standard McLuhan talk, and he's probing I.A. Richards. I don't know if I have an answer by I.A. Richards. It might be in my file somewhere. I'll come across it, but I don't recall right now an answer from Richards. But Richard was pretty old by then. So for the people listening, I said this a week and a half ago. The quote, I laid out the quote by Marshall McLuhan in 1956. Quote, Chaucer is the only great writer Joyce never mentions. I think it is typical of Joyce that he does not mention directly the writer who meant most of all to him. This is not the place in which to describe the debt of Finnegan's Wake to the Canterbury Tales, ... So that was my quote, and then I said, so who's the writer slash artist slash scientist film director slash film director that McLuhan never mentions who meant most of all to him? Now, that's pretty provocative. I don't know if anybody meant most of all, but there is this person that had incredible influences from the beginning, way back there, 1950, that I think should be laid out. So this is my answer to Andrew about make the case, Bob. So Don Thiel was born in New York City area, and he grew up in Mount Vernon. He was born in 1928, October 12th or 13th. When I brought Don Thiel together with Gerd Stern around 2005, Gerd, they both had a relationship with McLuhan, but Gerd Stern was the artist-poet, influential in the mid-60s with multimedia installations, and Don Thiel was the critic, the guy studying the latest movements in the art worlds to sort of notice someone like Gerd Stern. And they had never talked to each other, and what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, so one of them was born October 13th, 1928, and one of them was born October 12th, 1928. Huh. So, Carol, if you have a chance, you can maybe Google Thiel for obituary to see which one it is, October 12th or 13th. So these two guys, born within 24 hours of each other, Gerd Bird, born in, you say, it's G-E-R-D, Gerd Stern, S-T-E-R-N, so you pronounce it Gerd. That's what Gerd prefers. You don't say Gerd. So Gerd was born in Germany, and by the mid-30s, his Jewish family had to get out of Nazi Germany. So they came to New York City, and so Gerd grew up in New York City like Don did. Don was in the Bronx area up near Fordham. I think it was called Mount Vernon, and I think it's near Fordham. So they both grew up in New York City and had that cultured world. Gerd Stern's mother, her best friend was Henry Kissinger's mother. So Gerd went to the same school as Henry Kissinger. So there's a lot of interesting anticipations of what's going to happen later, because, you know, McLuhan's going to call Kissinger the trigger man. He also called him the kiss of death. So in 1979, just before his stroke. So there are these two kids growing up in New York City, and Gerd leaves home by the time he's 16 and goes to the village and becomes a village poet and meets everybody, gets involved with everybody. I call him the Forrest Gump of the art world. Well, Don Trump is the Forrest Gump of literary criticism, of art critics, of all kinds of things. So Don Trump told me that – Don Trump. Don Thiel See, so you say Don Trump for the last 2 years. Don Thiel told me that his parents were upper middle class, big deal in the Republican Party. And he, as a sensitive kid, didn't like the behind-the-scenes politics backroom stuff that he saw as a young man growing up in Mount Vernon. So when Korea came, he made a break for Canada to avoid the draft. But where was he when he did that? He was at Yale, and he was a very smart guy, so he got in the top part of the class. And in his class was George Bush, who became president, the first George Bush, and then George Carver, who was the CIA controller of Vietnam, in the 60s. So all these Skull and Bones guys were in Don's class. He never was asked to join the Skull and Bones. But his professors were two people that had McLuhan's PhD, Clint Brooks and William Wimsatt. And maybe one or two other guys in there, Robert Penn Warren, whoever else was part of that gang. They were called the New Critics. They were teachers of the New Criticism that came from I.A. Richards and F.R. Leavis out of Cambridge that McLuhan learned when he went to Cambridge in the mid-30s. So here's Don Thiel being coached by McLuhan's buddies in the same field. But Don's also a mathematician, so he's got both angles going, artistic, literary stuff. He's like McLuhan. McLuhan was into engineering and then literature, but he chose literature. Well, Don chose literature too, but he did have a mathematical talent. So Don tells a story that one day there was a big pile of papers on either Brooks or Wimsatt, one of those guys' desk, and he says, "I got to read this monster," says that to young Don. And what is it? He says, "It's a PhD by someone named Hugh Kenner." And nice. I guess Hugh Kenner, he comes to Yale. How's that? Yeah, he comes to Yale like after Don, right after. But Don was around the office and saw the thesis at some point, you know, 49, 50, 51 or something. So here's Don going to fate. Hugh Kenner is already a student of McLuhan's before Don, but Don's going to end up with McLuhan, and Kenner is going to go on 20 years later to write a book called The Pound Era to define the men of 1914 and Pound's great role as MC, sort of. But Don Thiel is going to counter Kenner's thesis 25 years later in 97, no, maybe 95, 24 years later, with his, and he purposely counted it, the Joyce era, not the Pound era, it's the Joyce era. And right. He wrote that in Peterborough, Ontario, where Hugh Kenner grew up. And Hugh Kenner wrote the Pound era, maybe out in California, but he's pretty soon going to be a professor, I think, at Carnegie Mellon in that area, around the New York area. So they switched places, Kenner and McLuhan. Kenner and Thiel, which is an interesting synchronicity. Okay, so Don Thiel wants to, in 1950, he's 22 years old, he has to do a master's and then do a PhD. So he graduates with his BA, I guess, at Yale, and he wants to go to Canada. Well, where should he go? So Brooks and Wimsatt told him to go to the University of Toronto and check out Northrop Frye and Marshall McLuhan. So he arrives in Toronto in, I think, in June 50. I don't think he comes up and checks. I think he checks out when he gets there, so I'm not sure. He checks out these guys. So he visits Frye, and then he visits McLuhan, and there was no choice. McLuhan was the guy. Whatever energies McLuhan was giving off or knowledge, that's what Don wanted. Frye didn't appeal to him. So he becomes a quick smart student of McLuhan in the summer of 1950. He also gets married to Joan around that time. I don't know where they got married, in Toronto or the States, but so they're just setting up house. And he's a postgraduate student. But very quickly, he shows McLuhan a book called Cybernetics by Norbert Wiener. And Don, with his math science knowledge, had reviewed Cybernetics the year or so before, at the Yale newspaper or Yale whatever you publish at Yale. So here's Don making McLuhan aware of the scene going on at MIT, which McLuhan wasn't aware of. And so McLuhan pretty quickly writes a letter to Norbert Wiener. I don't know how much he looked into what they were doing, but he read the book. And he writes a letter to somebody saying the real artistic scientist leading edge action is happening at MIT. The people around Norbert Wiener, he says. The literary magazines, literary claques, which may mean cliques, the small magazines, he says, are nowhere near what's going on at MIT. So there's McLuhan's technocultural influence or interest. You know, he's shifting there, caused by Don Thiel, 22 years old. And So then they formed a Finnegan's Wake group. I don't know how familiar Thiel was of Finnegan's Wake in 49-50 before he came to Toronto, but they form a reading group with three or four other people, and they go into Finnegan's Wake in depth. So McLuhan is really impressed with this young man. He writes to somebody about Don, you know, private letters. He's got a real smart young chap here, and so over the next couple of years, 50, 51, 52, maybe into 53, McLuhan goes to Don's apartment, Don and Jones Thiel's apartment, every afternoon, maybe not on Sundays or Saturdays, but pretty well every week, every day during the weekday after he's been teaching. So he hangs out with Don for 2 to 3 years. And so Don really got into in-depth conversations, and he even said that at some point McLuhan told him that I'm going to go for some kind of power. And
which years did you say this was? The early
it's between 19. He shows up in Toronto in June 50. He bonds with McLuhan pretty quickly. And then I guess he starts taking classes in the fall of 1950. And McLuhan starts hanging out with Don as much as possible from 50 to 53. There's a reason it stops in 53, which I'll get to. But for 3 years, he is, he's got a sophisticated American student there with him from New York City who knows a lot of different things and also knows, how soon he knew McLuhan's PhD, but he knew the men who were influenced by it and was taught by them. So McLuhan couldn't have got a more perfect student who is comprehensive. Mm-hmm. He can do science and art. And so McLuhan starts confiding in him and telling his ambitions, and Don said that McLuhan was looking for maybe become a newspaper columnist somehow. That was how he was going to start becoming an influential somebody outside of academia. So Don said his ambitions to take some kind of authority position or cultural influence was quite apparent to Don, at least McLuhan told him that. And you see McLuhan sometime in the 40s, doesn't he write a letter saying, when I go back to Canada, I'm going to rip the hide off it. he might have said that before he went to Assumption University in 1944, but it was quite early he said that. So Don avoids the draft, and McLuhan avoided the draft. He got out of there in the United States in 44, ostensibly to meet with Wyndham Lewis up in Windsor and start a journal at the University of Windsor, which was at McLuhan's time called Assumption University, a Catholic university, I think. And they never got the magazine going. The war ended, and Lewis's wife wanted to get back to England, so they took off. And McLuhan and Lewis got mad at McLuhan to help make the break, I guess. So so Don is avoiding the draft by going to Canada. McLuhan's getting back to Canada to avoid the draft. But now in 50, 51, 52, McLuhan's got this ideal student. And if you listen and watch McLuhan's Wake, you know that documentary on McLuhan came out in 2004, 2005?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, there's interviews with people, as extras, and one of them is Patricia Bruckman. And Patricia Bruckman was a student in this period, 50 to 53, and she mentions the McLuhan's into the conspiracy stuff, the cult of the West and the cult of the East. But she says, really, the person you need to talk, you have to interview Don Thiel about that period. He was the bright star among the undergraduate students of McLuhan, and the one that obviously could lead in the translation of what McLuhan was talking about. Okay, so another thing that Don did is he explored the occult and the secret societies with McLuhan, and Don once gave me a list of all the books they went into, and there's like 100 of them, and really obscure alchemical texts and strange books. They really went into it. So, mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Don writes his master's, which I can't remember right now what it is. But anyways, the important thing is he gets to his PhD. So he's gonna write on Eliot, Pound, Joyce, and Yeats. Yeah, Eliot, Pound, Joyce, Yeats. He's not going to do Wyndham Lewis because mm-hmm. Wyndham Lewis was still, you know, kind of suppressed. His paintings were locked up in the National Archives, the ones that he did for the Canadian military, I guess, in World War One. So Don felt that he couldn't get really into Lewis. But McLuhan wanted him to do Lewis. He got to do Lewis. So Don had several children by then. He and McLuhan got no salary, very low. So he's got to get his qualifications to be a teacher, get his PhD as soon as possible. So by 53, he told me that he stopped answering, you know, McLuhan's in endless phone calls. And a lot of it, McLuhan bugging Don to do the Lewis. You got to do the Lewis. So Don knew he wasn't going to do the Lewis, so he didn't answer the phone for a year, and he finished his PhD. Now, I've read it, and it is incredible. It's a explanation of what McLuhan taught about Yeats, Pound, Joyce, and Eliot. Each section is a brilliant explanation. You can tell that it's Marshall talking about it, because the PhD is called The Communication Theories of these four guys, and right. That's the buzzword, communication theory. So the head of the English department, I think his name is Woodhouse, you can read about him in Marchand's biography, he doesn't like the new critics. He's what's called a history of ideas literary critic, you know, a concept guy, you could say. And so he really headed in for McLuhan, and there are stories about that tension in Marchand's book. But Don said that when he gave his oral in 1954, his oral testing of his PhD thesis, Woodhouse was on the panel. I think Ted Carpenter was on the panel. McLuhan was definitely there. And so all through the interview, or whatever they call it, the presentation, McLuhan was putting down Don at every step well, he had a motive, but he was really giving Don a hard time. But Don did it and passed the test. And that night, Woodhouse called him, and the oral, people from the oral are not supposed to talk, back then at least, yeah. to the student that just went through the test. But he was Woodhouse was so amazed at the thesis, he said, we could build a whole new school of literary criticism on your thesis and what you just presented to us.
Right.
And Woodhouse has no clue that it's all McLuhan stuff, because
yeah,
McLuhan purposely pretended he was against it all the way through the interview.
Interesting.
So it was a setup. Okay, so here is Don's thesis, being accepted by McLuhan's enemy. That, and McLuhan probably, well, he doesn't know it's going to have that effect, but he's definitely knowing that this is an important thesis, and I got to pretend that I have no influence on it. So that's a pretty big dramatic thing, and credit to Don. Now, when you read the thesis, you have to be impressed that a 24-year-old could understand McLuhan and lay this stuff out, you know, and get it accurately, understand what McLuhan was teaching. That's where I give Don credit for his genius as a young mind. Who the hell understood McLuhan back then? nobody, and Woodhouse didn't even recognize it as McLuhan teaching. So,
right.
But that's 54. Back in 52, 53, when, the other influence. So apparently, as Ted Carpenter tells it, he met McLuhan casually or something in the late 40s, maybe at lectures and stuff. They knew of each other. But Don says that he, in that first year, took courses from McLuhan, but he also took courses from Carpenter. And he said, I realized Carpenter was the kind of person, a fascinating guy, that Marshall should get involved with. So he brought Carpenter into McLuhan's world. He forced them to get together. And so Don caused that connection, which is pretty amazing. Meanwhile, Carpenter and McLuhan become, you know, fast friends and colleagues. And they go to some anthropological conference in 52. I think Ted Carpenter writes about this in his appendix to Don's book, The Virtual Marshall McLuhan. And they realize, well, we could do something about this. And so they get the idea to go for a Ford Foundation grant. And Don, this young guy, is in the middle of it, and he said that he wrote the proposal. I guess McLuhan and Carpenter were busy. They told him what they wanted, and Don wrote it.
Right.
That's pretty amazing that he's going to write this proposal or be the secretary for it or the clerk that does the hard grind part of composing something. We know that as Explorations unfolded, the journal that they got the grant for was mainly done by Ted Carpenter. He's the one who did all the editing and organizing and corresponding with everybody. And McLuhan was too busy doing whatever he did as a early media ecologist. So Don did the legwork. So then he does the PhD, and then he starts teaching at St. Michael's with McLuhan in the same department. And you have that great picture. Have you seen it? They're walking, McLuhan and Don Thiele walking along the campus. It's around 1956, 57. You got a tall McLuhan and a short Thiele. You ever seen that? And,
yep.
And Don Thiele in his white Bucks. So there's Mutt and Jeff sort of thing. You know, there's Pinky in the Brain. There's the conspiracy. And already by that picture, in the second Explorations, Don wrote his explanation of Finnegan's Wake called Here Comes Everybody. And
right.
That essay was so amazing that the woman who buried James Joyce in Switzerland, the wife of Siegfried Gideon, who McLuhan had already met, and maybe he had met his wife, I'm not sure, Carol Gideon Welker, but she was a literary critic and an aesthete, and she wrote to the Explorations gang and said, this is the best thing on James Joyce written yet by anybody. I mean, he got a major compliment from a woman who had probably had many dialogues with James Joyce because James Joyce was, safe house by them in 1940 when he escaped France and went to Switzerland. And go ahead.
Oh, nothing, just saying. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Welker, Carol, and Siegfried, they were with him. He was only there like for a year, and then he died in January 1941, so they buried him. So you have someone very close to the Joyce world, and I have it from other sources that Gideon and Joyce really could talk, and Joyce could tell him about his media ideas. And that's why McLuhan said that Siegfried Gideon's 1939 book, Space, Time, and Architecture, was one of his major events, you know, reading events, intellectual events in his life. And that's long before Innes. So McLuhan is sort of saying Gideon is a guide to new knowledge in the 40s, and he talks about him in Mechanical Bride. So here's Don Thiele getting complimented by it inside Joycean. That's pretty incredible. And that essay, when people read it, you have Derek de Kerckhoff in our conversations done a few years ago. He came across it and read it and said, holy crap, I now understand Finnegan's Wake. That's the power of the essay.
It's a good one.
Yeah.
It's good.
And, of course, it's a lot of Marshall stuff in there. But Don knew how to write it up and present it. And there's several other people have told me, like Derek DeKirchhoff, I wish I had met Don. I should have talked to Don. You know, I didn't know that he wrote these kind of things. Didn't follow. Wasn't into him that much. So a lot of people regret not meeting Don and exchanging information with him. So Don goes on to be a professor at St. Mike's. And in 1960 or so, when Marshall got ill, was when Claude Bissell was expanding the University of Toronto on the University of California system. I guess it's called a megaversity design. And
right.
I don't know how much McLuhan agreed with it. I don't think he did. But he being ill, and he was on the board of the University of Toronto representing St. Michael's College, in the discussions among the four or five colleges of the University of Toronto set up, they're all based on a different religion or Christian sect. And so they're all discussing and trying to adapt to Claude Bissell's, who was an old friend of McLuhan's in the English department, and is eventually going to give McLuhan the Center for Culture and Technology in 63. But in 1960, McLuhan is ill, so he has to send another representative to the meetings among the colleges. And so who does he send? Don Thiel.
Mm-hmm.
That shows you the respect he had for Don Thiel. Now, that's in 1960. Don, in his book, tells a story. He mentioned it to me once. In the late 50s, CBC was interested in media or whatever they were hearing from McLuhan, but they couldn't understand him. So they asked Don. They figured, well, I don't know if they – well, Don knew a lot of people in the Toronto scene. And the CBC guys knew Don, so they said, okay, why don't you tell us, write up a report explaining McLuhan. And he did that. But McLuhan found out about it and told Don, no, don't tell him everything. We must have a level of mystery, a level of mystique. I know you know, but don't tell them. And I don't know what Don did. I don't think he tells, he never told me what he, how much did he reveal. I don't know how much he took McLuhan's advice. But that's a good sign that McLuhan is watching this young whippersnapper come up, and he's got to watch him. He's got to, you know, he knows too much. And so that's an influence. I mean, Harold Bloom wrote in 1971, I think, the anxiety of influence. People who influences on people aren't necessarily people that you like or that you use, but you have to go through them and around them. So in this tension between Don and McLuhan, it fits into this theme of Harold Bloom's The Anxiety of Influence. So so McLuhan has tried to get Don to cool it with the CBC, but then the next year or so he lets Don represent him at St. Michael's. So Don is a young professor. He told me he got to see the power bureaucracy in academia, what the top guys do in the bureaucracy, and he got fascinated by that. So I think that motivated him in the long run to become a president of a university. But then that leads to another idea or epiphany. But back to the late 50s. Mm-hmm. So Don wants to teach what his PhD is about, you know, the modernists, the men of 1914, and McLuhan won't let him. And McLuhan, I guess, was teaching the stuff, and he wouldn't let Don also teach a course. So after, in the early 60s, Don realized that he was forever going to be blocked by McLuhan, so he left St. Michael's and went to York University, which I think just started around then, 1964. Now, I don't know how much Don, he never said whether he attended the early seminars that McLuhan was doing even before the Cocho started in 63, but I guess there's a bit of a strain there because, you know, Don's forced to go somewhere else. And so he gets a gig at York University, and he starts his own interdisciplinary seminar that McLuhan was running at the Coach House from 63 on. So So in 64, 65, 66, Don is doing it, and he has all these top up-to-date people, including Patrick Watson, as part of the seminar. You know, Patrick Watson, the CBC broadcaster.
From the, the This Hour is 7 Days.
Yes, and that show.
With that? Yeah.
Yeah, he did that show. He was the host of it, and that was a famous Canadian show in 66, 67 or so. And so he became famous doing that, and he interviewed McLuhan on that show. But Patrick Watson was hanging out with Don Thiel and part of the seminar, so that Don was given whatever This Hour of 7 Days, if there was a major show, a major theme, Don and his seminar with Patrick would go over the show before it was broadcast. They'd talk about it. Maybe he may even influence the CBC people. Now, that's in 64, 65. There was another guy, Frank somebody, who starts Leonardo magazine, very interesting magazine at MIT, I think, in Harvard. And he had a computer guy on there and some other people. Maybe Arnold Rockman was on there. But he had a really modern interdisciplinary. They had a geneticist. So he was doing what McLuhan was doing at the Coach House. And he did that for a couple of years. And then he got scouted by McGill University. So he went and taught at McGill in 66, 67. And that's when Expo is being built. And Don is appointed to archive the Expo, 67. So he meets everybody in that Expo world as he creates a collection of whatever went on to the making of all the pavilions. But he also saw that it was a McLuhan-themed situation, or he told them it was a McLuhan-themed situation. So he put up all these little aphorisms by McLuhan all over the Expo. So
That's awesome.
Did you say awesome?
Yeah.
Yeah. So here's Don. He's got tension with McLuhan, but he recognizes McLuhan's important, and he's still working and translating McLuhan and trying to get people to talk about it. He said his last conversation with McLuhan was at Expo in 67, just before McLuhan went to Fordham. He was talking to him at a cocktail party or something, and so they discussed things, I guess. But he did notice that Marshall looked very ill, and that was because he had those weird benign tumor on his brain. So meanwhile, Don, at McGill, he becomes the Abbie Hoffman of McGill in this sense. Because of the radicalism, and Don was brought up a Roman Catholic, but he wasn't being a Roman Catholic formally in the 60s. So he was a radical, interested in the left. I think he was more of a lefty socialist guy. But he told me that he was always a Joycean anarchist. That's what he called himself, a Joycean anarchist. So whatever he was interested in the turmoil among the students. So a young student named John Feketti, F-E-K-E-T-E, Feketti or Feketti, he was a student of Don's. He took over the student newspaper, and he started publishing, pornographic or dirty stuff from Paul Krasner's The Realist, which was the radical underground newspaper out of New York City. Paul Krasner is a legend. So somehow he was, pushing the boundaries of academic decency or what students should see. And he got in big trouble. And so in the trial, whatever McGill set up, the university put Feket on trial and tried to get rid of him as editor of the paper. And Don Thiel defended Feket. And he was – and so Don gave me articles of the newspaper – the McGill student newspaper of this hip professor, Professor Thiel, helping our students, helping the radicals. So he got a reputation for being on the side of the students and being on the pro-student level of the identity crisis going on in the universities around Vietnam and everything else in the late 60s. So Feketti probably becomes an understudy of Don, and when Don becomes president of the University Trent University in Peterborough, Ontario, he invites Fiquette to Fiquette a gig at the university, and I think Fichetti's in I'm not sure what he's in, political economy or something, but he writes a pretty good book in 1977. It's him as a lefty saying that McLuhan completed the English literary tradition, picking up from Eliot and those people, and McLuhan wrapped up and put it away. But Fiquette, as a people's guy, is exposing the elitism of McLuhan and the Eliot tradition. So it's a great criticism. Well, not a great, but it's a very interesting criticism on a sophisticated literary level of what McLuhan did, what McLuhan represented, and Fiquette doesn't like it. So he's teaching this stuff at Trent in the late 70s, early 80s, I guess. And but when MTV comes in, no, what is it? Cable TV. Yeah, MTV comes in the early 80s. And so this TV reality, cable TV takes over. Fiquette has to reassess his evaluation of McLuhan, and he writes a mea culpa article in 82 where, I nailed McLuhan too early, which is what I have always said. These critics, whoever read McLuhan and nailed him, tried to, make fun of him in the late 60s. You can see those essays in McLuhan Pro and Con or McLuhan Hot and Cool. They went after McLuhan too early. McLuhan hadn't laid out his cards completely yet. They didn't know about the manipulative satire and all that. So, but Don knew all that, and I guess Fiquette didn't get that from Don, but by 82, he wrote a reevaluation of McLuhan. Anyways, back to Don's at McGill, and he is. Now, why I say he's a film director is that he became the mentor of all those famous National Film Board filmmakers in the 60s, 50s, 60s. You know, Norm McLaren and all these other names, which I remember back in the 60s, they show up in all the films. I don't know if you know any of them, but there was this core of people that were, putting National Film Board on the map.
That's important.
Yes, and so Don was, maybe he got involved with them in when he went to McGill, because there was a heavy contingent in Montreal, I think. Or he was already involved with them because I won't say that sentence yet, to finish this point about the NFB. So he would run the summer workshops where the directors would talk to whoever came to learn how to make films or documentaries. So Don was the intellectual leader, and probably he brought in a lot of McLuhan knowledge and stuff, and the NFB guys thought this was pretty good. But he decided to hire John Grierson, the inventor, sort of documentaries, back in the 30s and 40s, he was part of the British war effort in the Department of Propaganda, I think. So, John, have you ever heard of him? John Grierson? G-R-I-E-R-S-O-N. So he's a famous guy that becomes identified with the National Film Board. So Don brought him over, and he told me that Grierson drank a lot. So in hanging out with Grierson, which Don had to do, like babysat him, so to speak, made the transition to Canada, Don had to drink a lot with Grierson. So he gets sick. He gets a health problem, and he's put in the hospital in 1970, I think, the summer of 1970. And while there and whatever the issue was, I think the guy's name is Hugh Cameron. He mentions him. Oh, it's over. I can get the book. Let's see. Who does he acknowledge? The book, The Medium is a Rearview Mirror, comes out in 1971. It's the first book published by the McGill Queens University Press. They had joined McGill and Queens University. And so the first book they did was Don Thiel's book, and his book starts off, "This book only came to be through an accidental conversation. Over cool drinks on a warm summer day, Dr. Hugo McPherson, then Canada's government film commissioner, so there's the film thing, questioned my statement that I would never be guilty of perpetrating a book on Marsha McLuhan. Out of the problems raised in that conversation, I began writing a short paper for personal perusal and realized that the subject occupied my mind enough to lure me into writing a study of the works and influence of the Toronto specialist in culture and technology. For that initial conversation and for subsequent conversations, I owe particular thanks to Dr. McPherson. He then says, my greatest debt, of course, is to Marsha McLuhan himself, with whom I worked as a graduate student and as secretary of his first culture and communication seminar. That's the Explorations Seminar. If, as the book indicates, our interests have developed divergently, it was through his role as a masterly teacher that I, like many other students, first received my initiation into combining an intellectual life with pursuing the study of English in a university. Then he says, for many years, Arnold Rockman, who I think became a professor at York, for many years, Arnold Rockman and I discussed McLuhan, his exasperations and values. Professor Rockman offered many suggestions about the current book and provided even more help by being a constant source of stimulating conversation about those areas in which this work is involved. For constant encouragement and suggestions received from Dr. John Gerson of McGill University, whose knowledge of the communications field is a vast resource and whose criticisms have been invaluable, I wish to record my thanks. Then he goes into other colleagues that he thanks, Northrop Frye, Professor Malik, Professor Darko Suvin, who became an early professor expert on science fiction films. He was from Yugoslavia, I think. Professor Gopnik, Professor Weems, and Professor Isvan Anhalt. There's an interesting note. He says, the year before writing this book, I directed a thesis for Mr. John Fiquet on McLuhan. So I think that's the book. That became Fiquet's book in 77. And the constant discussion of McLuhan's work and Fiquet's work was a great help. So there's that. Okay, so now we go into, he doesn't say he was ill when he wrote the book, but he told me that he decided to spend the time and laid up in the hospital and change his ideas about whether to write a book or not. He said, yeah, I'm going to do a book. And so he did it while he was sick. And in the course of the book circulating and Don getting copyright permissions, McLuhan objected. He said, you were using way beyond fair use, too many quotes from me. And it became such a scandal, and you can read about it in Don's The Virtual Marsha McLuhan, which comes out in 2001, his second book of McLuhan. He has an appendix where he provides the documentation and shows how five university presidents in the Maritimes and eastern part of the United States of Canada got involved in arbitrating whether Don was overdoing or not. And apparently Don won. And so McLuhan had to back off, and Don was able to include all the quotes he did. So people say, you know, Marshall was very pissed off at Don. Maybe. But it didn't matter. It was an issue that was an academic thing, not based on personal emotions. Unless McLuhan wanted to stop the book, worried about what Don would reveal. So a big factor where McLuhan, in a way, made a fool of himself trying to stop it. So there's a big influence on McLuhan that caused by Don, you know, unwittingly. So Don gets over that, and the book comes out, and everybody, you know, who's reasonably aware of what's going on around McLuhan recognizes this is the book on McLuhan. And a couple of people said, this book makes McLuhan look good. McLuhan will never get a better book than this. So it was really appraised a lot. And
I was about to react when you said the book on McLuhan. I'm going to say, well, at least, you know, to date, you know, not necessarily the definitive wrapped up and put away, but better than all those other reactions, you know,
yes.
More informed, more giving people a good chance to, anyway,
get a clue
better to date.
Yes, up to that date. And in that year,
but then you said someone said no one will ever write a better one. and so that's probably too much praise for it. But
yes,
yeah.
Well, Don had to write a better one later,
right?
Himself. But that's the year 71 when Jonathan Miller does his ridiculous book on McLuhan. Finkelstein had done a book in 68 called The Sense and Nonsense of McLuhan, a Lazi guy out of New York, a horrible book. There's been the pro and con books with varying degrees of interesting essays, and then McLuhan Hot and Cool. So nobody is aware of what McLuhan came from, like Don is. And so Don lays out the influence of all the poets and writers and filmmakers, Eisenstein and Moholy Nagy and these other artists, not just literary. And the lucky people who read Don's book, like Elena Lamberti or Jessica Pressman out of Yale, came out of Yale, who did a book that's a good follow-up of Lamberti's book, Marshall McLuhan's Mosaic. Jessica's book's called Digital Modernism. They both give kudos to Don Thiel. They learned a lot of stuff. I may not agree with him completely, but they acknowledge Don Thiel. So he does the book, and in 74, 75, I think, he's invited to be the first Canadian professor to be allowed to go to China, to Mao Zedong's China. So he's this exchange professor in China. Well, I don't know if there was an exchange, but he's over there and spends 6 months or something there, and that's pretty interesting for him to see the Chinese world, the communist world. And in the same period, he goes to maybe on the way back from China, I'm not sure, but he goes to some university in France, and he does a seminar, I don't know how many months, but he lays out his ideas about media and, you know, para-McLuhan, post-McLuhan, or McLuhan-esque. And Don later found out that the notes to his, whoever was in the class, the professor or students, they took notes of what his lectures were about, and it got sent up to Sorbonne and and was circulated among Roland Barthes and all those closet McLuhanites.
Nice.
And so he had an influence.
McLuhan, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he had a an influence on, I don't know, Baudrillard, but whoever was part of that circle that was interested in McLuhan in the early, mid-70s, because Don recognized some of their ideas in their writing, in their writings were directly from him, what he had said in his course at, I don't know what the university was, I have to look that up. It might be, no, I think it begins with B. Anyways, it's not up in Paris. It's out in the boondocks, whatever university that was. Or out in the non-boondocks. I don't know about that, eh? I don't want to be caught putting down the university. But he's at least whoever's there at that university is smart enough to invite Don over. He recognizes that Don has something to say. Okay, so then Don, what else? He then gets the offer to be the president of Trent University. So he goes to Trent, 79-80, and he's now got power, and which is what he was looking for, academic power. I don't know what his goal was, but it certainly wasn't neoconservative, because by 1986-87, there was a local wealthy guy who gave a lot of money to the Trent University. This is what Don told me, and was promoting neoconservatism, whatever that is. And Don had sponsored a avant-garde film festival in Peterborough. And they brought in all the heavies of the underground cinema world, probably of the 50s, 60s, 70s, into Trent, into Peterborough, and it was quite controversial from the conservatives' point of view, or the right wing. So they made moves to get rid of Don. And they eventually forced him out of the presidency of Trent University, and it was funded by this billionaire guy. I don't have his name. So it was so vicious, they did not give Don a pension or whatever you get when you retire.
Yikes.
They cut him off. He was going to be poor. You know, he had no money. And so what happened is his supporters, and I should say, let's just go back a bit. In the 50s and 60s, especially in the 60s, when McLuhan was becoming famous, McLuhan is touring all over the world, giving lectures and on media and TV and all that. You know, he's riding this big wave of McLuhanism, and it's in a way too busy for local stuff, and also too busy to be part of the counterculture that people thought McLuhan represented, because all the students and hippies and all these people read McLuhan and thought they understood him, mm-hmm. thought he was a guy validating their tribalism, their neo-tribalism. Right. And so they always were asking McLuhan to come to their scenes and be an Abbie Hoffman kind of professor, sort of like a professor that Don was at McGill in the late 60s, supporting the radicals at the newspaper, student newspaper.
Right.
So here's the interesting thing, is that Don Thiel, he lived out what McLuhan didn't have time to do. He right. was the one who went around and interacted with everybody, and he edited the Arts Canada special issue on Wyndham Lewis with Sheila Watson. He did all kinds of other stuff all the time. He met all the artists, all the scenes. He went to in the mid-60s, he went to New York City and became part of EAT, Experiments in Art and Technology, led by Billy Kluver, and Claus Oldenburg was there. He got involved with the art world there. He was everywhere. So in my retrospect, what people thought McLuhan was part of and was promoting, people thought McLuhan would be hanging out with those people and be part of the Yoko Ono Fluxus group or something. I mean, he did do articles for some of their journals and things, but he was at this point, he was hobnobbing with Vice President Hubert Humphrey, which Ted Carpenter didn't like, told me personally, and part of the he's getting on a tetrad management levels. He was there consulting with all the big corporations. He was not on the street, so to speak. Now, Marshall gets back onto the street when the Spadina Expressway thing starts happening in 1970 or so in Toronto. McLuhan actually gets out there and is part of street protests and lobbying for a local issue that he wasn't seen doing before. Like Professor Carey, the American political economist, his essay in McLuhan Pro and Con is about comparing Innes and McLuhan, and Carey makes a big deal. Innes is more important than McLuhan, but I saw Carey speak at the Media Ecology Association's first dinner or something in 1998-99, and he talked about McLuhan, and he said that, I think this is where I heard it, he said that he would invite McLuhan to speak, and he was very involved with helping draft dodgers or get people out of the Vietnam War thing.
Right.
And he wanted McLuhan to speak on that and address the problems of his students and the problem with the draft. And McLuhan wouldn't do it. And right. Carey didn't like McLuhan's avoidance of local issues. And I don't think he understood McLuhan. McLuhan was speaking on a huge satellite conductor level. You know, he was probably being asked all kinds of local things, but he had an alibi. He was explaining spaceship